From the Sky News Centre at 7, Boris Johnson's ordered cafes, pubs, bars, restaurants and gyms to close from tonight to help stop the spread of coronavirus. Nightclubs, leisure centres and theatres are also being told to close their doors. The measures are taking place across the UK and Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon says the advice to the public was to stay away from crowded places, but that hasn't worked.
In light of advice this afternoon from our scientists and the Chief Medical Officer that there must be strict compliance for that to be effective, I am now asking restaurants, cafes, pubs, gyms and cinemas to close.
These drinkers in Wolverhampton tell us why they've been going to their local.
You can't just pick and choose what you want to close. If you're going to close, you close everything. You can't just pick on the pubs.
I don't see the problem in popping into the pub, keeping a safe distance away from anybody and supporting my local pub. I don't want them to shut down.
Meanwhile, the Chancellor's also introducing measures to cover the wages of staff who'd otherwise lose their jobs because of the virus outbreak. Rishi Sunak is going to pay businesses not to lay off workers, covering 80% of their salaries. Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell thinks the Chancellor should have done more to help workers during the crisis.
He hasn't gone far enough, and I'm worried about yet another delay in getting these benefits to people, getting the wages in people's pockets. He's shifted not far enough and not fast enough, but I'm hoping over the next few days we'll be able to improve upon that when he comes to Parliament on Monday.
Earlier this afternoon, schools closed for most pupils and they probably won't return for months. It's also been revealed GCSE and A-level students in England will be given grades based on teacher assessments instead. And government experts think social distancing restrictions might need to be in place for a year to prevent the health service becoming overloaded. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Secker.
BCFM.
Our guest on the politics show on BCFM this evening is Anthony Negus.
Working for the clamp down. Yeah, I'm working hard in Harrisburg.
we've got Anthony Negus with us. And Anthony, good evening.
Hello, how are you?
Well, we've been devoting our time to talking about the coronavirus. We wondered what plans you had got in the Liberal Democrats for talking, you know, for coping with what life will be like after this.
Well, I very much hope that much of life will be the way it was before. But I think there are some signs that if we get this right, it could actually even be a little bit better, which is which I think is quite comforting. I mean, the fact that there seems to be a lot of conversation now going along between government and all the instruments of how this country works, and with a common purpose, I think is a really encouraging, positive sign. And I think we should carry some of that positivity with us. It's you know, it's going to be a bit of a bleak time, but there might be some good things here. I think we've got to concentrate on those.
Yes, and Bristol will change hugely, won't it? Because all places of entertainment are now closed down. And that is one of the changing factors, probably, for most of us. Things like, you know,
the fact is that we're all in the same boat over this to a large extent. I think that's not a bad place to be in many respects. We're not just Bristol is not just suffering this. It's not just every other part of our country. It's every part of the world that's basically going through something like this, and depending on what sort of things people wanted to do outside their own house, it's nevertheless going to affect everybody in the world. And I think that's a great leveler. And I think that's potentially very, not to say exciting, but it's certainly very encouraging. We can certainly make something out of this, surely. We can surely grow from this. There's been a lot of talk about comparisons with the war, which I think is perhaps not the last war, which I don't think is particularly the right way to look. But certainly, there was a lot of common purpose. There was a great deal of camaraderie and appreciation of everyone in our society. And I do hope that some of that comes out of this process, because there's going to be quite a few things that won't be very good, and we've got to concentrate on those that will be.
Well, earlier, Martin and I were talking about, you know, life and so on. And Martin said, for a lot of people, it was shopping and their next holiday that were their priorities. That is surely going to change. And possibly that's not such a bad thing. I mean, you know, you don't like to pour oil on troubled waters, but already, like you say, it's a bit of a leveller.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't try to condemn people that actually see the next corner as being brighter, the next high spot in their life as being bright, as being something that we want to avoid. I mean, or get away from. I think everybody needs something to look forward to, I just think that it may be that we'll perhaps get a bit more used to looking forward to things which are much more easily achievable, much more near at hand, much more gentle and community-based, if ever we get back to communities again. I've been much encouraged. I've been staying in, and I've already had three messages and a couple of things actually put through my letterbox saying that there's people out there offering to help should I need any help. I think that, I mean, isn't that terrific?
Yes.
I mean, that really means that there's people out there that are really trying to see, looking after everybody else. And that's really what I hope comes out of all this.
Yes, because we were talking earlier about the greedy way that some people are shopping, you know, hugely piled up supermarket trolleys and empty shelves for other people. That is something which, you know, that will presumably fade into the background as people find out that life is not perhaps as hard as they feared.
Well, is that selfishness or is it fear? If you've got a family to feed, then you have a massive responsibility to make sure that family is looked after. And I do think that that will tilt people into doing things which otherwise they perhaps may not have done. And I think you've alluded to it. I think this is a short-term thing, which I think it'll straighten itself out, and people will begin to realise that they can get into a pace that works for everybody. But there's certainly a lot of fear at first, and this has never happened before. I mean, people are referring to 100 years ago with the so-called Spanish flu around the First World War. I mean, there were no provisions made, really, to deal with that. People simply died. People became ill and died. And here we are seeing a lot of regulation, in fact, massive regulation, which is affecting all of our lives. So it isn't really equivalent. But so really, perhaps this goes back even further than 100 years ago, when we've actually had these... We've actually been so contained, kettled, as it were, and I think we've got to understand that this is almost completely unique. We've actually had the experience of something which is truly awesome and terrifying, alongside the ability of governments being able to pull levers to try and mitigate that problem. I don't think those things have ever been happening together before, ever.
And one of the things which is massively different now than has ever happened before is we have all been so used to international travel. Now it appears that international travel is on lockdown and it may never recover. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, I someone that hasn't actually done a great deal of international travel, which I actually rather regret now, but... I do think that there is a difference between people going somewhere to expand their horizons and to enjoy a break, and those people that literally fly regularly all around the world just to sit down at a table and speak to people. And I've always found that absolutely mad. I've got a bit of a pedigree here. I was actually involved in the first video conferencing that ever happened, and it took place from a telephone house in Bristol, and it was a link up with Brighton, with BT and Brighton.
When was that?
And that was weird. You know, you had to wait for the camera to come and reach you and all the rest. These days you can do it with your mobile phone, with your smartphone. It's easy. Why don't we do a lot more of this? So we've got all of these tools at our disposal. Why on earth do we have to go halfway around the world just to shake hands with someone, drink a cup of coffee with them and say to them what we could have done over a link?
Yes. Yes, I was talking to the director of the university's theatre conservation department recently, and she said she had a phone call from somebody one day. The woman was in America. She wanted to know when they were open. She appeared 10 minutes before closing time in Bristol the same day. She'd flown over. She read through a script and then she got the taxi back to the airport and went again. I mean, that is just horrendous, really.
Well, I think you very much illustrated my point. I think that there are... I've always believed that we've overdone the air travel, I think there are ways to make it perfectly possible for people to enjoy themselves without indulging in so much air travel. And you know, we've had a good decision recently about Bristol Airport and about Heathrow Airport, and I think they're, in the light of what's happening now, I think they'll prove to be very timely and sensible decisions, because I do think you're quite right that we will see a very, very slow recovery, and possibly not ever a complete recovery of air travel, which I think was beginning to become absurd in some respects. So I'm very pleased that that this is just a step along the way, as it were.
I think some people, though, are fearful that we may become Little Britain, you know, this island where nobody goes in or out. What do you think?
Well, isn't every country in the same way? I don't think the world is going to suddenly recompartmentalise into fixed boundaries, you know, very solid boundaries. My goodness, I hope not. I mean, I'm an internationalist. My party is very much of trying to break down those sorts of barriers. That would be a very worrying consequence of what's been happening recently. I think that's unlikely. I think that might be a part of the initial fear process, that we're all thinking that because things have changed right now, they're going to stay changed. I think we've got to understand that this is a completely unprecedented, really, really out of anything we've ever done before situation. And my guess is that we will revert generally. I think it'll be perhaps take some time. It'll be at different paces. There'll be different communities and different societies. But I think basically the world will go on. We've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of years of development behind us. I don't think even something as cataclysmic as this is going to knock that completely off its gimbals.
No. And one of the things that I know Martin and I have agreed about earlier is there are a sort of underclass in this country which are really suffering and are probably going to suffer more. How do you feel that we can bring them up? I mean, as far as your party goes, I would say that you're probably fairly near the Greens, aren't you? In outlook, generally.
We're Liberal Democrats and they're not,
yes,
of course.
And oh, well,
that,
yeah.
That's quite a strong distinction, because environmentally, the Liberal Democrats obviously were the environmental party decades before the Greens were invented. And in fact, when I was 18, I joined the Liberals, as was, because at the top of their banner were three words: internationalism, the environment, or four words actually, internationalism, the environment, I've forgotten the last one now. It's completely gone as I'm talking to you.
But it was something worthy.
Basically about people living and working together and respecting each other. And those were my values then, and they're certainly my values now. Although we would strive to deliver, and I think delivery is the important thing in terms of making a sustainable future for us all, we would strive for that. I don't see that as being something that must be legislated for and people whipped into doing and made to do and everything nationalised and you know, taking out all the creativity and the opportunities that I think we as a party are very keen on. I make much of my effort within Bristol City Council as trying to work with other parties as much as possible. Where I've been successful, as I have been in the past, in driving out motions in full council and getting them won, which is it's quite unlikely, but it's happened several times. My first response then is to try and get a cross-party working group to take it forward. And that's certainly happening with the climate emergency. We have a climate group. You'd be really surprised, and so would your listeners, I think. One of the first things that group was asked to do was to set down its priorities for how we were to go forward with this, and to put down its red lines. In other words, things that it would not countenance are doing. Now, the interesting thing was, with the four parties that were represented, and I may have got this wrong, two parties, and I'm not saying who they were, two parties had absolutely no red lines at all. One party, if I recall correctly, had one thing that they didn't want to happen, and one party had two. None of those things were, and have proved to be as we move forward, of particular significance. In other words, all parties were keen to move forward and to try and make this work. And that's what I think is the... That's the the goals that you should be aiming for, is to try and find consensus and work with it rather than try and exploit differences.
Yes, yes. And the banking crisis is a side thing to this, isn't it? Because obviously there's been billions of pounds that have been promised that will come out of this disaster. And whichever party picks up the baton in Bristol, they are going to be looking at reduced finances, aren't they? Is that something that you can work with?
It depends whether my party also believes in sound finance, I think we've had some a very bad spell in Bristol with the previous mayor, who ended up with an unforeseen or unspotted serious deficit, which made the national situation even worse in terms of the funding that we had available. But there's also been a lot of lack of clarity and a lot of things going on in the background about paying people off and trying to do things without revealing it, and there's been a lack of transparency. All of these things, I think, you have to, if you're in a bind, and we will be in a bind probably for at least a generation after this. It was two generations after the last war that we were still paying off debt. It'll be at least a generation from the present crisis, and probably more. But the only way to deal with that, the best way to deal with that is being completely open and making it quite clear what your objectives are and how you're doing things. And I think there's been a pretty poor record recently in Bristol of us not being open with these things, and that's partly because there's been a lack of trust, I suspect, between this incredibly sharp pyramid of top-down governance that we've got, or government that we've got in Bristol under the mayoral system, but also I think that itself generates a lack of trust from the people. From the ordinary citizens want to be able to know that things are being done honestly and fairly. And you're quite right, there's always an underclass, and anything like this means that the people that are in the worst situation come off worse. And we've got to be really, really careful to make sure that that doesn't happen. I mean, a very simple thing is the food bank situation. I mean, that has a very interesting generation in terms of donations and volunteers and all the rest, the way it works. Now, lots of those pieces of that absolutely essential thing are going to fall away, and we need to be really, really careful that people are, first of all, in the immediate thing, we find a way of maintaining that supply of provisions. But in the longer term, we've got to eliminate that. We've got to get rid of it. Well, it's got to be that people are able to hold their chins up and be a part of everybody supporting each other and trying to find a way of smoothing out this tremendous gap between the rich and the poor in this country.
And there is nothing like a bit of a wobbly in the economics for cutting the roots from under the food banks, because several people I know that work in food banks, and I heard an appeal go out on this station earlier this afternoon for nappies, baby milk, things like that. The food banks get least help when other people are being squeezed. And we're seeing supermarket shelves that are empty, and we're also seeing the big bins that supply the food banks also empty, because people are just thinking of themselves. And not everybody, but I mean, it's a really big problem if you're running something like a food bank, because in the summer when people go on holiday, that's another example of, to a lesser extent, where they run out of pasta and things, because the people that routinely put stuff in, they're all off on holiday, they're forgotten. But at times like this, it really needs a bit more than stuff that's donated out of baskets, doesn't it?
Well, that's my point. I mean, at the moment, in our current situation, that situation is clearly that it's a very flimsy, is not the word, but it's a very delicate instrument anyway. And in the present situation, that is and will continue to break down. And there has to be another way of doing that. What I was going to be doing on Tuesday, had we not stayed away from full council, I was going to be bringing a motion about trying to get greater cooperation with the supermarkets, who already do quite a lot, but need to do quite a lot more to deliver some of the things that are causing Bristol City Council some costs and some problems, and causing, you know, the environment to suffer. But also nationally, we need to get a grip on the way that some of our major players behave. We ought to have a code. I called it a compact. But we need to try and work with people rather than ordering and legislating for things to happen. I think that we can actually get a lot more out of people, and maybe this will come out of the present problems. I don't know. We'll get more out of people by openly cooperating more and making it very clear that we've all got a common purpose. And I think that's my own view, is that is a very sound way of delivering the things that we really need to do to go forward. And in the short term, you're right, we have to make other provision for the food banks, but in the longer term, we should get rid of them. There shouldn't need to be people depending on this. It's an unsound way, and frankly a very unfriendly way for society to deal with these sorts of issues.
What did we do before food banks?
Well, one of the good things is that actually nowadays that there's probably a better knowledge of where people are and what their problems are, and the outreach is pretty good. The simple answer, and it still happens today, you know, even with food banks, that people go short. People don't eat. Their children eat, and they don't. And I was hearing a woman the other day who actually on the radio, who actually worked as a teacher, and she was saying that some times of the month she actually can't go to work because she can't afford sanitary products for herself. That is awful. That is just an appalling thought, that we haven't got a state which can actually make sure that people are allowed to have dignity and the ability to work and the ability to run their own lives. And that's being taken away. We have to get the bigger balance sorted out here. There's a very big, higher problem here that we've got to iron out in this country.
How do we get into this situation, I wonder? Because we were saying earlier, the banks have maybe not acted responsibly, to put it mildly. Is it the banks' fault? Is it the government's fault? Is it the expectations of society? What is it, Anthony?
There's always the counterplay between people that want to strike out on their own and do good things and plough their own furrow, and people who are simply content to be part of a larger engine and not want to make that sort of profile necessarily. And I think this does create a big chasm in the middle of people pulling away and from the mainstream. Now, I think there's always a very careful balance between promoting creativity and entrepreneurship and yet making sure that what comes out of that in the longer term is ploughed back into the society that's needed to sustain that system. And we've you know, there are problems with this. We have to reward people, certainly at the very early stages when we're getting when things are getting off the ground. But that reward goes very deep into businesses going forward. And we do see some absurd and frankly quite awful things happening, where the imbalance is such that it almost can't be restored. We now have an incredibly complex tax system in this country, and it's made very much more difficult by globalization. I can almost see Martin nodding as I say this. Will take a lot of sorting out, and it will certainly take international resolve to get some of these things right. But you're quite right that things have been going wrong for quite a long time. But remember that we've always had land ownership and an elite. I mean, it seems to be the way that society seems to organise itself, so that people do rise to the top. I don't condemn that, but I do see the need to make sure that there should be a much greater understanding that this is actually happening, and try to make sure that it can be a fairer, more open way of dealing with the problem. We cannot have people queuing up for food banks as anything like a medium term solution. It's unacceptable.
Yes, and housing is a kind of currency now, isn't it? If you are able to own property, you can rent it out to somebody else and they can pay your mortgage, basically. What do you think about the whole housing situation, particularly as it applies to Bristol?
Well, Bristol has one of the greatest imbalances between house prices and salaries. You know, we've got an incredibly high percentage of numerical relationship between salaries and the ability to buy houses, and that's it's to a certain extent it's a sign of the city's success. Some of the other problems we have in the city are also a sign of the city's success over time, and homelessness is one of those. We're quite attractive to people who end up sleeping rough, and I mean, the figures of that have just recently gone up quite dramatically, despite all the efforts that this administration has taken to try to make it better. That figure has skyrocketed in the last 2 or 3 months, and that's a very bad place to be. We need to be a lot more inventive in the way that we create housing. I personally, and probably be a bit boring here, but as a Liberal Democrat, I believe very strongly in the value of land as part of this equation. And although we, like lots of other local authorities, we do deals with private developers and try and scrape a little bit of affordable housing out of that. In fact, the value of that housing then goes up, not because of the value of the actual housing, it goes up because of the value of the scarcity of the land upon which it sits. And I think there's a clever move here to try and better control or better understand the value of the land as part of that equation. There are things called community land trusts, which are very often seen as just self-build organizations. I think the great advantage of things like community land trusts is that if they're set up properly, the land can be the part that escalates. And what you sell, if you move in or out of that development, is you simply sell the value of the house or the flat or whatever it is that sits upon that land. So the land itself is gathering a lot of money, but that doesn't work its way through the market and therefore make it impossible for people, young people particularly, to buy something that's halfway affordable.
Now, Mayor Mervyn Rees has got his own way of dealing with this. He said that he wants to see cranes on the skyline. Building up is a popular solution with some people, extremely unpopular with others. As far as you're...
Well, certainly not for me. I spent my life as an architect, and most of my life I was under no illusions about building high. Building high is not financially the cleverest thing to do. You can certainly deliver the densities by building much lower than some of them. I mean, we've got two or three tower blocks around Castle Park at the moment are going to be absolutely ghastly. They would change the whole face of Bristol forever. And I think that's a terrible shame. We can do this in another way. And apart from anything else, socially, it is so much better for people to be nearer the ground and more engaged in common public space than they are in a blooming great tower block. I think he's got this wrong. He makes a lot of fuss about seeing cranes everywhere. He wants to put this incredibly expensive and overblown metro through a very small part of the city, as it turns out, and he wants to completely change the face of Bristol around the Cumberland Basin, which is a tragedy, I think, for Bristol, which has been a city for 1,200 years. Not his city, as he so rightly said and actually repeated, although he says he actually said it to me in a cabinet meeting, though he said he's never said it's not his Bristol, that part of Bristol. But I tell you what, Marvin Rees, it's certainly the Bristol that many Bristolians would see as being their Bristol, and it's certainly internationally, in terms of our tourism and our attractiveness and our USP, it's certainly something which a lot of people come to Bristol to see, and they don't want a blooming great flyover sat in front of all that. That's a mistake. So I think a lot of this is self-aggrandizement. It comes with a job. You know, as a mayor, you want to make a big fuss about what you do and who you are, and you've always got to think about the next election. So you keep saying grandiose things. It's not doing Bristol a great number of favours. I don't know how much favour it's going to do Marvin Rees come the next election, but it's certainly not good for Bristol.
Well, we're obviously not going to have the elections, which we expected in May. Who would you back as the prospective mayor for Bristol?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to say this. I would obviously back the Liberal Democrat candidate, Mary Page,
yes.
Not only because she's a very sensible, pragmatic and a very human being, but because she is the candidate who's standing to get rid of her job. She's standing as a mayor with the aim to campaign vigorously so that when we have the referendum, which we could have in 2022, I wonder if the present mayor will encourage that to happen. I doubt it very much. But Mary Page would certainly campaign and work with a view to scrapping her own job so that we can get rid of this wretched mayoral system, which is such an awful top-down system that every day we see more examples of people not being trusted enough to be told what's going on. There are things going on behind the scenes which we can't find out about. Things are obscured from us. Things are left until the absolutely last day before a decision is made, before anybody else is allowed to look at them and comment upon them, by which time, of course, it is clearly too late. And that's the point. And that is not democracy. It's not a good system. If we've got to have a metro mayor, and there's a lot of sense in us having a sub-region where we can do some of the bigger things cooperatively with all the areas around here, it really doesn't make any sense at all to have two mayors alongside each other. And it's just a bad system, and we've got to get rid of it.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Anthony. That's a really different view, which is, it's always good to hear, because I think just at the moment, everybody, A, because there's no election imminent, lots of people have sort of given up. And the other thing, of course, is everybody's so completely obsessed with the virus, which of course you'd expect, and it's almost as though anything could happen and nobody would notice anything different.
Well, the Liberal Democrats make no apology for trying to be different. We certainly have a very different view about many things, and it's often a very pragmatic, delivery-based way of doing things, working with other people. So I very much hope that people will understand that we have a very clear view about how we want the city to run. And it's going to be inclusive, and it's got to be fair and include absolutely everybody in the decision-making. We're not seeing much of that anymore. That's a great sadness.
And so say all of us. Thank you very much, Anthony. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Roma. Bye, Martin, as well.
Bye there.
Cheers.
No, well, there's some people who want to talk. Yeah, well, sometimes we take it. But he's been a regular for years.
So, Martin, now talking to Anthony there, he had quite a few things to say, didn't he, about the mayoral system. What do you think?
Well, I've never been in favour of the mayoral system, and Marvin's aware of that. It was an idea that was dreamt up by the Conservative government with the Liberal Democrats in tow, if you remember, and it's basically they're copying what happens in the US, where you have these kind of celebrity mayors running big towns and cities. And, of course, that's not really the way we run things in this country traditionally. But, you know, there used to be essentially a kind of cabinet government at local level. You know, the dominant political party would, you know, you'd have a committee running things. I mean, Ken Livingstone was always never in favour of elected mayors. When he did his most radical stuff in the early 80s when I lived in London, he was the leader of the GLC Labour group. He wasn't the mayor of London, and it wasn't just about him. You know, there was a whole team of people that were running the city with a certain vision, and that's basically the British way of doing things. We don't really believe in presidential politics, although increasingly our politics has become more Americanised and personalised in that way, and I think that's bad, basically. I sort of tend to agree with Anthony. Although, as I say, the Liberal Democrats were in coalition with the Tories when they brought this mayoral stuff in. Although, to be fair, the Liberal Democrats locally were always opposed to it. And, you know, I used to chat to them in that era and, you know, we pretty much agree about that.
I think it's also interesting, the concept of a prospective mayor who is acting to make herself redundant.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, that's a political stance, isn't it? I mean, I think the Greens, I don't know whether they've said that they're going to get rid of mayors. Obviously, I think Marvin would not be in favour of getting rid of mayors because he is the mayor. I think that it's not going to change quickly. And, you know, what's another interesting thing about the mayoral system, one of the things I do agree with, is you've got a transferable vote. It's not like a first-past-the-post election to Parliament. So you can vote in order of preference for the mayor that you want. You've got two votes. So, in other words, you can vote for what you really want, and then in your second vote, you've got to vote, you know, with your head against what you don't want. So, for example, you know, you could vote Green for mayor and then Labour as your second choice if your Greens didn't win, and vice versa and so on. And that, of course, is basically moving in the direction of proportional representation. And I'm in favour of proportional representation, as Liberal Democrats have always been. I mean, basically, first past the post, we were talking about this earlier, it's like it turns it into a cricket match where, you know, you're either in or you're out, and you're either batting or you're bowling. And in actual fact, it's a much more complicated phenomenon. You know, it's actually better to run things in a more consensual fashion. And I say that as somebody who would probably be on the far left of any consensus. But I recognise that if you're going to get things done, you've got to work with people that don't share your views, and you've got to carry them with you. You can't just, you know, win winner takes all is not a very sensible strategy for running anything.
No. And when it comes to the building strategy, what about that?
Well, we've had a lot of debate about this on the show over the last couple of years. George Ferguson's an architect, and obviously Anthony was an architect. And there's a lot of professional architects who aren't very happy with Marvin's, basically he's going with big developers and what they want, which to a certain extent he has to do. You know, people say, well, he could do it differently, but the developers decide what they're going to do in Bristol. And the idea that the mayor or anybody else really tells them what to do. I worked at the council one stage, and, you know, the developers basically got you over a barrel. And I think the problem is that because we've had all these cutbacks from central government, and what they've done is they're going to give the business rates back to local level. And that means if you, as a mayor, can get loads of fairly wealthy businesses operating in the city centre, you can then get the business rate from them, and then you can use it to, you know, give people in the communities what they want. But I think that's just wrong, because in other words, you're doing a deal with the devil with the developers to get the money to do the basic things you want to do. Ultimately, that's just wrong. We should have a fair allocation of resources so that you could actually, you know, you didn't have to put yourself in the position of giving way to developers to get what you wanted done. And that's what they've designed this to do. I mean, the Tories designed this system to work like that. And, of course, it's all very well, a city like Bristol, which has got fairly high property prices, you might be able to extract quite a lot of money from that and then spend it. And that's, of course, what the GLC strategy was in the early 80s, as Livingston said at the time, because they used to have business rates. Said, if I put a half pay rate on the City of London, that gives me a slush fund of millions of pounds that I can then spend in the poor communities in the city. And he actually exploited that, because he could see that could be done. And of the Labour group at the time, you know, Ilsid Harrington, Lewis Herbert, who's my councillor, they all agreed that was a good. And of course, what happened was that when they started doing that, the central government said, you can't do that. And they abolished the GLC. So London, for a certain period, had no local government at all, because it was becoming obvious that was a mechanism for redistribution. And of course, London's a big enough place that there's enough poverty there that you've got, you know, the money that you're getting from the city and the property is, you know, it's redistribution within one city. But of course, it's not really fair. South Wales is never going to be able to function like that. You know, they need central government or EU funding or something if they're going to keep a basic physical infrastructure in place, social infrastructure. But I mean, all of these things, you know, we were talking earlier about what's changed in this country in the last generation. And that's one of the things that's changed. You know, I mean, when I went to school as a kid, there was they used to run the swimming baths, they used to run the schools. And I was in school a few years ago now, where a young boy, 7-year-old boy, he pooed himself in the pool, and we had to get everybody out, and he was a bit upset, and I had to, you know, my job was to sort of make him feel all right about it all. Anyway, the pool had to be drained, and that then sent the school a £3,000 bill.
What?
Which meant that, of course, the summer vacation trips and so on all had to be cancelled. And that's because the swimming pool has become a private enterprise, effectively, and the school is now an academy, and they are two business units. And if you cause us to have to unfill the pool, then you have to pay the bill for £3,000, which means that the school then runs out of resources. Now, when I was a kid, both the pool and the school would have been run by the local council.
Yeah.
So it would have been a very unfortunate incident, but there would have been no financial implications.
Well,
different era. And, of course, we were talking earlier about why people go to food banks. Do you know what? In the 1970s, unemployment benefit and Social Security was enough to live on. Mm. And they deliberately made it less so.
Yes.
And that's why we've got food banks. It's quite simple, really.
It's not even that. Lots of the people that use food banks are actually working. They just don't earn enough to live.
Oh, that's real wages have been driven down.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what used to happen, and this is quite an important point, up until 1973, as productivity rose, because in modern capitalism, productivity does rise because you're inventing new kit all the time, which makes work more efficient. And you can normally expect through technological change an increase of productivity about 3% a year. But what used to happen is people's wages used to rise at 3% a year. And when I was a kid in the 1960s, people got bigger wages year by year. That's what the consumer society was built on. And they could guarantee that as long as things didn't go, you know, as long as they carried on working, whatever, they would get a better lifestyle, and their children would have a better lifestyle still, because the productivity increases because we had strong trade unions. Remember those? They went to the workers. But having smashed the trade unions, as they did all over the world, now productivity has carried on increasing on the same curve, but wages have stagnated in the United States of America since 1973. Real wages haven't risen in the United States of America since 1973. And that's the reason, that's the fundamental cause of the crisis. Because ultimately, capitalism works with well-paid workers who are working more intelligently. And if you break that linkage, you ultimately end up with a situation where they can't buy back what they've produced. And then you have to give them debt, and then that becomes a debt mountain, and then it crashes, and that's where we are.
It's not just what's done to the workers, though, is it? I mean, do you know anybody now who goes, I'm really working class? Because working class and unions are confused. Lots of people think they're a little bit too posh to be in a union. And
also some people just think that the union, they're just irrelevant. Because people used to go to work in big factories and they would be inculcated into the culture of work, which included being a member of a trade union. And of course, they don't anymore. Deliveroo and some of these other young people going around delivering stuff, they've formed their own independent workers' trade union. But they've done it with no support from the mainstream trade unions, apart from, you know, a pat on the back. And they've had to start from scratch. But, I mean, there was an era. I mean, in Scandinavia, in places like Norway, trade unions are still strong.
Yes.
Yeah, the North Sea, which is a nationalised industry in Norway, everybody is in the trade union who works in the North Sea. In Britain, nobody in the North Sea is in trade unions because the American companies that we allowed in to do it smashed the trade unions years ago. The Oil Industry Liaison Committee, Ronnie McDonald, they used to try and organise trade unions up there, and they were all sacked and prevented from going back onto the rigs. And that's a difference between us and Norway.
Well, there's another difference, and that is, in this country, do you know anybody in the legal profession that's not in the bar? Do you know any doctor that isn't?
Well, I mean, that's not called, you see, that's professional associations, not trade union. Although, you see, the junior doctors went on strike not that long ago because of their hours and so on. And that's, you know, that is actually a sign that, I mean, the healthcare workers that are now risking their lives out there, often them are doing it for remuneration, which is no way represents the level of commitment or skill that they're putting into it. You say, well, doctors are well paid, but doctors have all got stonking A-levels. They could all be business people if they wanted to, and make loads more money than they do being doctors. But they want to be doctors, and that's why they do it. And that's what we want. We want people who want to do that. But they also need to be respected and not made to work ridiculous hours, which they were being made to do. And, you know, that's perfectly legitimate for them to strike in those circumstances, isn't it?
It is. Well, come the revolution, Martin, and who knows, the revolution might be quicker than we think at this rate. I mean, life will change. We're apparently going to be in lockdown for up to a year.
Yeah.
And even when the libraries change, you know, the libraries are closed. What's going to happen?
Well, it's going to be interesting because all of these chickens, the chlorinated chickens, the sky is dark with chlorinated chickens coming home to roost. And, you know, isn't it interesting that all that stuff about Brexit, this is a very important point, there's various people are saying, well, they're going to have to postpone negotiations about Brexit. Because basically we've got a world crisis on our hands and we can't really waste too much time squabbling about that. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen, but there's no reason why it's got to be done in a certain timescale. But of course the Tory right wing are committed to getting us out by June, effectively. They've got to do a deal by June or bust. And that means as we go into this massive tsunami of a crisis, Britain is going to have its own circle of hell.
Well, that's the end of the programme. Thank you, Martin, and thank you, Anthony, and here's the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.